Good morning. So last time we went over doing secure communication when we had to assume that sort of our communication medium was sort of being interfered with. And we focused in this class on two security properties that are most often the ones we are concerned about, of confidentiality, that we want to keep things secret, meaning only known to the people who are supposed to know them, and authenticity, meaning that we want to know that when we receive a message, that it's actually the message that was sent by the party we're communicating with and not something sent by someone else or a manipulated version of the message that was sent. And we had kind of two tools for with different versions for this, for dealing with confidentiality. We had encryption, and we had two versions of encryption. We had symmetric encryption, where we have one key, something akin to a password. We had asymmetric, where we have these key pairs with a public part and a private part. And the public part could be used to do encryption, and the private to do decryption. For authenticity, we had message authentication codes or digital signatures with both. Gave us something we could use to verify they were produced by someone with some secret data. And message authentication codes are the symmetric version, so there's one key that's shared between both parties communicating. And in digital signatures, we have that public-private key split, so the private key generates the signature, the public key verifies it. And we mentioned that even though we have these nice mathematical tools, they're kind of easy to misuse. Like, an assumption we have is, oh, if I have a message and it decrypts successfully and I check a signature on it, that means I can just use the message and I'm good. And the problem is that often we're missing context about that message, and this allows things like replay attacks, where an attacker takes an earlier message and puts it in a context that it wasn't intended for. And kind of the fix for this is to add information to the message that you sign and or encrypt that ties it to where it needs to be used. And the kind of normal technique we saw for this was a nonce, a number used once, where you just label the messages with a number that makes it so we can't take the message and put it somewhere else, because then the number won't match up because, well, it was only used once. Then we talked a bit about a big practical problem with all these encryption schemes and message authentication schemes. It's just that, well, we need keys. And we need to get the keys somewhere, and public keys make this easier, but still don't solve the problem of how do we know we have the right party's keys. Especially in contexts like the web, where we have lots of websites with all different keys we want to communicate with. And we talked about the idea of certificate authorities, which are how we at least pretend to solve this problem on the web. That we have some entities that we trust to sign certificates, which are basically messages saying, here's the public key of someone else. And because we trust those parties to do that, that's a way we end up verifying identities of, say, web servers, where by identity I mean the public key of web servers. And I'm being careful to use the word trust, because trusting something doesn't mean it's trustworthy. And this is particularly relevant in the case of things like certificate authorities, where I can say we trust them, that doesn't mean that we, you know, that's a foolproof solution. So questions about things we covered last time? Moving on way far away from our networking stuff. Okay. So for basically the rest of the course, we're going to be talking about topics related to how processors work. And for that, we're going to probably start off with what I hope is basically review of CSO1 stuff, and also like a particular model of like how a processor works that we're going to extend. And I have a diagram here of kind of components of a processor. This, you know, notch thing here, this is a register. And this is the program counter register. Hence PC. And I'm showing a processor that hypothetically executes one instruction every clock cycle. So the way we'll say our register works is that every cycle it reads in its input value and stores it, and during the cycle it's outputting its value that it has. So this CPU is going to be outputting the address of the instruction to access. It goes to our instruction cache. I should probably label all these in. And we get out the instruction parts, which are going to include, for example, any constant in the instruction, and information about what registers to read, and, you know, any information about the operation the instruction is supposed to perform. We're going to take the information about the registers to read, put that through the register file, and get out our register values. We have some circuits that do what I've labeled as math. So ALUs, that you may have learned about, adders, multipliers, shifters, those are things. And after that, for some instructions, we need to access the data cache. And when we do that, we have to compute the address at which we access it and also the value that we're going to store for storing or for just loading. Well, we don't need to compute a value to load. That's the data cache's problem. And then we will sometimes get a value out of our data cache, and sometimes we'll have a value from the math that we'll get and use to write to the register file. And my assumption in this design is that our register file, at the end of every clock cycle, it just looks at the values coming in on its inputs and updates the registers. And the register file, to be explicit, like, contains all the registers except the PC that we can see in assembly. And the other important thing we have here is that in addition to our PC going to the instruction cache, it also goes to the circuit that computes where the next instruction is. And I'm assuming in this case we're not handling jumps, just to make this simpler. Obviously a real circuit would handle jumps, calls, etc. So I just add the instruction length, and that gives me my next PC. And when the clock cycle finishes, the PC will take the value that's coming in here and copy it as the program counter for the next clock cycle. So this is kind of a simple idea of a processor design. You know, simple in the sense that I've omitted some important details, maybe not in the sense of that it's absolutely simple. That takes, you know, one cycle to run every instruction. Questions about sort of my notional design we're going to start with, because we're going to modify things where it'll be pretty confusing if we don't know what's going on here. I'm asking especially because, you know, if you took equivalent CS someone elsewhere, you might have seen a different sort of starting design. Rather not. Okay. And so our normal way that this execution works, if you look at some specific instructions, is, let's say I have this add instruction at address 100. This 100 will flow through to our instruction cache and our instruction length circuit. Our instruction length circuit will compute 180, and that will be sitting on the input to the program counter. And at the same time, we will send the 8 and 9 that are going to be somewhere in the machine code for that instruction to the register file, and we'll get the values of these two registers, which we're going to assume when this instruction starts are 800 and 900 hex. That goes to the math circuit, which is going to look at the opcode and realize that it needs to add them together and get 1100. That goes to our register file, which is going to update R9, which also needs to be, you know, passed in to the register file so it knows to do that. And then execution will go to the next instruction. So in this example, that's our move queue here. So we're going to read that instruction from our instruction cache, get the register numbers 10 and 11. We're going to add the constant 1234 hex from the instruction to the value we get from register 10 to compute the address to send to our data cache. And our data cache is going to retrieve the value in memory from that address. And then we're going to end up storing it in the register file in register 11. And at the same time, we're also going to compute that the next instruction to run is 110. So you can move on. So questions about kind of our execution of these two instructions that we've seen here. So something to observe about these two instructions is that we have kind of a lot of work that needs to happen, sort of, that when I've described it, I was describing it kind of in steps, that we would first, you know, do our reading the instruction value, then we'd read the registers, then we'd do some math, you know, and in this case, after doing the math, we'd access the data cache. And this seems pretty, you know, sequential, and it kind of has to be sequential because of how the circuit is laid out, right? That we can't access the instruction cache until the math is done. We can't do the math until the registers are read. But our design for this processor is that we don't go on to the next instruction until the previous one is finished. And this should give us some pause that there's some performance we are sort of not getting here. And to talk about that performance, I'll talk about, you know, thinking about doing another task that's, you know, where we kind of have an intuitive idea how to make this faster. And we're going to apply that idea to this circuit, but, you know, I'll use an analogy where it's maybe more straightforward. So let's say I have a couple loads of laundry to do. And if I'm applying the same algorithm that circuit applies, how we do it is first I do the first step of doing the laundry, which is the washup. Then I do the second step, the dryer. Then I do the third step, folding everything. And after I'm done with all that, then I can move on to the second load. This is just how like our processor works. We do the first instruction, go through all its steps, access the instruction cache, access the register file, do the math, access the data cache, write back the values to the register file that we computed. Then we do the next one. So this is kind of the timeline we get if we apply that same algorithm to doing laundry. So does anyone here do laundry like this if you have two loads? So what do you do instead? What do you do instead to, you know, yeah?
I'll, after the thing out of the water, actually, after the kind of wash, I'll put the colors in the washer as well as the points of
view. Yeah. We say, gosh, why is the washer not doing anything for almost an hour? And the dryer not doing anything for almost an hour? Like, it's pretty intuitive to us that this is not an efficient way to do laundry. But our circuit is doing the equivalent of this, right? We access the instruction cache, and after we're done getting the right value from the instruction cache, we just keep waiting before using it again. Well, the instruction cache isn't really doing any work. We already got the value for this instruction. And we really want to timeline something like this, where you can see in this case, you know, I can squeeze, you know, and a full additional load of laundry in the same time. So we're going to want to try to modify our circuit to get this kind of efficiency, and we're going to call this pipelining, that I'm going to have this sort of pipeline of thing, you know, this queue, like assembly line of things to do, and when I finish one step for the first instruction, I'm going to do that step for the next instruction, sort of, so we have things sort of run behind another, just going through our steps. So something to note about this sort of idea here is that, you know, even though I kind of squeeze things in, we still have sort of these gaps in time. Right, we have time where we're not doing anything useful with some components. So even though I said I'm going to keep using the washer all the time, right, I didn't end up, you know, actually having the washer 100% occupied. And this is probably an unrealistic picture because I don't know about you, but my washer is faster than my dryer. So it's probably more like this. Right? So we end up having, you know, that we're not like actually using things the full amount of time. We have this waste of time where I'm just waiting because something later on in my steps, later on in my pipeline, is not ready yet. And so, you know, if we're looking from an efficiency point of view, if we kind of evaluate this naively, we might say that this is less efficient. So one way we'd say that is, you know, I'm not using the washer when I could be. The other way I'd say that is, well, if I consider the time it takes me to do one load of laundry here, once things get started, because I have this time where I'm waiting for the dryer to be available that I didn't have when I was using my naive method of do one load, finish it, do the next, it takes longer. And so by this metric, if you ask me how long does it take you to do a load of laundry, this method of doing loads of laundry is worse. But none of you would ever suggest, therefore you shouldn't do this, right? Everyone thinks, you know, it doesn't matter that this takes longer to do one load of laundry, because that's not what we care about. And when we're talking about instructions, we'll call the time from beginning to end, like I'm measuring here for this load of laundry, the latency. So it's time from when we start to when we finish. And it's very easy to say for instructions, oh, well, you know, I should be minimizing the latency of all my instructions to make a faster processor. But if we want to apply this kind of intuitive optimization of doing different steps at the same time for different instructions, then we don't want to actually be measuring latency. It's the wrong metric. It's not useless, but it's not telling us what we really care about. If I have a bunch of loads of laundry to do, you know, I don't think it's beneficial to go down, you know, take this from a little over 2 hours to a little under, because what I really care about is the throughput. How many loads can I finish per unit time? The rate at which I start or finish loads of laundry. That's what I'm really trying to maximize. And in our processor, we're going to have the same idea, that we want to maximize the rate at which we complete instructions, which is going to be the same as the rate at which we start instructions, because in the long run, you know, I can't start an instruction until I complete enough instructions, right? Once I start too many instructions, I'm out of space. And the metric we care about in this case is like saying, oh, I can do a little over one load an hour, which is way better than what I was getting, you know, with my, if I just did one load at a time, where I was doing one load every 1.8 hours. And this is probably more true when we're speaking about programs, because programs have like billions of instructions we're going to run, like duplicated instructions, of course, because of loops. And we really, if we want to care about how long the program takes to run, it's how long does it take to run those billions of instructions, not any particular one. But we are going to kind of deliberately make instructions actually run slower by this metric to implement this scheme. So we talked about this idea for, what I call pipelining, which is, we do one step, then we move on to the next while starting the next operation, the next instruction on the first step. So we have this kind of, when things get started, we have this sort of continuous stagger time scale where, every sort of time unit, we're starting a new operation, we're advancing one operation to the next step, and so, for each step we're doing that, kind of things are going in lockstep with each other. So let's talk about, we kind of know how to do this physically. Let's talk about what we have to do to make our circuit actually implement this strategy. So first, we're going to have to identify our steps. And I'm going to choose what is probably the most common way of dividing a classical processor into these stages, which is what we'll call the steps. I'll have a first step I'll call fetch, which will also include notably computing the address of the next instruction to run. I'll have one that I'm going to call decode because all the literature calls it decode, but maybe a better name would be register read. But everything you see written about this we'll call this decode, regardless of how much actual opcode looking at this is doing. I'll call the stage where we do all our math, execute. The stage where we access the data cache, the memory stage. So note that it's not, we also access the memory in the fetch stage, but we call that a different thing. And the stage where we write things to the register file, the write back stage. And kind of once I've had this division into stages, it might seem like, so what I'm going to do then is that we're just going to, send out OX1000 here, and once we get the values of that machine code, then I should just, I'll probably color this. So sometime later, we'll get the values at that address, and we should change this to the next address. That might be kind of a naive way you might think we do this, that we just, after we finish one step, we just change what the PC has. But there's a problem with doing that. And the problem is that when we change this, we're going to have this timeline where if I think about here versus here, that our PC is OX1000, and then we get the memory at the instruction cache takes some time to compute something, and then it gets memory at OX1000, and then if we just change this input to OX108, the next address of the next instruction, right? That's what we want to do. We want to go on to the next instruction. Well, when we do that, what's the instruction cache going to do? It's going to say, oh, I need to change this to the address of the next instruction. And so this value is going to change. And that's going to really confuse our register file here, right? That if the register file wants to see register numbers that aren't changing, to do its op work. If we just change the input to the instruction cache, it's going to change the values it's reading and sending out to the register file. And we need to make sure that that only happens at a time where we know the register file is actually done. And we are going to have the same problem with our math circuit, that the register file is going to give us the values of those registers. We have to keep those around while the math circuit's computing it. So the idea of just, let's just change the inputs, after we're done computing them, doesn't work, because it turns out that our instruction cache and our register file, even though we think of them as being done with their work after they fetch the value, or for a math circuit, the math circuit being done with the work after it's computed the addition or whatever mathematical operation we're doing, after they compute that value, they're doing some extra work of holding the value there so the next step can use it. And if we just change their inputs to have them move on without doing anything else, then we're not going to be holding that value anymore and the next step's going to get confused. So our solution to this is that we're going to add registers between each of these stages. And a register is a tool that's going to let us decide, when do I want to update the value that's feeding the register file? When do I want to update the value that's feeding our math circuit? And we need that because we want to make sure that everyone moves on to the next step all at once, that we don't have to worry about, am I too fast? Am I too slow? Am I changing something you're using? The registers here that we're adding between each of the steps let us avoid that problem. Question?
So should we be thinking of this like each step would basically finish on our own first? I guess that was what my confusion was. I was like, if we input an instruction, it doesn't go all the way through first. It finishes all the steps I fetch, and then it's on the decode, which is why it would change the value and then move on.
So the question is, with these registers added, should we think of each step as finishing before we move on to the next? Yes. Which is what we were trying to do with our pipeline anyways. But the problem is that without these registers, we're not gonna we can kind of achieve that, but we're gonna mess it up as they see values from the next instruction when they don't want to. So questions? So we have these registers we're going to add between every step, so each of them can kind of act independently of each other, and we can control when we move from one step to the next. And to make this more concrete, let's look at what goes on with these registers and some instructions. And I have a diagram here where time goes from left to right, and I have this cycle number because we're going to have sort of one clock cycle that determines when we advance, these steps. So in cycle 0, we're going to run the instruction at address 100. So we're going to be fetching that from our fetch stage. So its values are going to be on the inputs to the registers between the fetch and decode stage. And also, we're going to have the address of the next instruction on the input to the program counter. Then we're going to have our clock cycle finish, and that's going to cause our registers, including the program counter, to read in their inputs and start outputting the inputs they got from the previous step. So in this case, we have our move instruction now being output by our PC, so we're fetching the values for move. And at the same time, we're outputting from the registers between fetch and decode the values from the add that we retrieved from the instruction cache last cycle. And that's going to go to our register file, so we're going to get the values of R8 and R9, on the inputs to the registers between decode and execute. And so in this way, we have our move instruction in the fetch stage, and our add instruction is in the decode stage. I should not highlight the right part of the diagram. And then when we move on to cycle number 2, now we're going to have our third instruction in the fetch stage, the XOR. So we're going to get the values for the XOR going into our fetch to decode registers. Coming out of our decode registers is the register number we need to read for the move, because that's for the move instruction, which is register 10. We're going to have to pass through probably register 11 and the 0x1234, you know, separately from the register file, so we can use them later. And also, we're going to be passing to these registers that are going to be going to execute in the next cycle, but not yet, the value of our tech read from the register file. And at the same time, our add instruction is going to be adding 800 and 900 together, and we're going to have the sum that was computed going into the registers between execute and memory. So at this point, you might say, gosh, your diagram shows that we're doing memory next for the add. Why are we doing that? There's no data cache access for this add instruction. But we're going to still do that. So in these pipelines, we're not going to just skip steps because we don't have anything to do. We're still going to go through every step. And the reason why is because we can't usefully skip steps if any of the instructions that are before or after us use the memory step. Right, we're going to have to wait for them eventually, and it makes the logic way simpler not to skip steps. So we're just not going to do it. So this memory step here, we're never using the data cache. All we're doing is passing this sum through here to the next stage. We're still going to do that. We're still going to take a full cycle to do that, because kind of in the worst case, this add might be after an instruction that uses the data cache, or after an instruction that is after an instruction that uses the data cache, or something like that. You know, so we can't reliably skip the steps, and it's not worth any benefit of like making logic to do that, so processors don't. So our add instruction is passing this value just through the memory stage and not doing anything with the data cache. Our move instructions in its execute stage doing the addition to compute the address. And our XOR instruction is just behind it, taking the registers 12 and 13 and reading those values and preparing them for the next cycle. So then finally in our cycle 4, our add instruction finally completes writing the value of 1100 to register 9. And at the same time, our move instruction is finally accessing memory, meaning the data cache, and our execute instruction is doing the XOR of the value from register 12 and register 13. And this will keep going. So we have one instruction following the next. And not shown here is presumably we have another instruction in decode, which are, you know, the next instructions from the machine code. So questions? Goes on in this pipeline. Yes?
What happens if you're XORing R8 or R9 in instructions?
So the question is, what if we have some dependency between these? Because, you know, I didn't write the value, this value, and yet we're computing something that could have been based on that value. It wasn't in this case. We will talk about how we deal with that issue later. The answer is things will, there's going to be two solutions we'll talk about. Probably we won't get to all of them until next Tuesday. The simplest solution is we run things slower. Meaning we wait. There's a better solution we'll talk about. Other questions? Yeah.
So are all these steps like
So the question is, what happens when these steps take variable amounts of time? You give the example of math doing a divide might take a while. I'll give the simplest example we have of something which might take a while is that caches here. We know those don't always take the same amount of time. And the simplest way of dealing with that is that we have some way of just not advancing anything that's before something that is waiting. Like if the data cache is taking a while because it's a cache miss, we just keep all the instructions from advancing that are before it until it's finished. That's the simplest way of dealing with that. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
And probably next week we'll talk about kind of the much more sophisticated answer for this when we talk about out-of-order processors, which is the kind of modern laptop desktop solution for this that makes all this way more complicated, but solves that problem in a much more, you know, performant way. Other questions? Okay, so this is our kind of simple-ish kind of. By simple, I mean simple compared to a modern laptop or desktop, not actually simple, way of doing instructions and steps. So, we talked about adding our registers. Let's talk about how efficient this actually is. So we talked about throughput and latency. So with this design here, let's say our cycle time is 500 picoseconds. What's the latency of one instruction? Just mainly, did you remember when I talked about latency earlier? I'll do show of hands. So who thinks A, B, C, D, E? Okay, so you have pretty good consensus on that. How about the throughput? And let's assume for this that we don't have any cache misses or anything like that, that we have kind of the ideal case. We'll talk about, you know, less ideal cases later. So what's the throughput in our ideal case? B, we're finishing one instruction each cycle. Yeah, so one way you can measure that is you said, this interval between finishing instructions is one cycle. And one cycle is 500 picoseconds. So we're finishing one instruction every 500 picoseconds. And note that this is going to be over the long run. Like, if you look at, like, if you just tried to, like, say, you took six cycles and finished two instructions, yeah, you can do that math, but that's not going to tell you kind of the long run performance of this design, right? In the long run, assuming no cache misses or things like that, we're going to finish one instruction every cycle and be starting, or alternately, we can view it as we're starting one instruction every cycle, or we're doing the, you know, execute stage of one instruction every cycle. Wherever we'll look, it's one instruction a cycle. And that gives us one instruction one cycle, and that's the same as one instruction every 500 picoseconds. Some questions? See here? Okay, so let's say talk about, so I showed you dividing things up into 5-stage, and I mentioned this is a sort of a very common design, and with the kind of notional processor I gave you, it was, it made, it seemed kind of simple to do because we basically, these were all separate components anyways. Let's talk about doing something which seems much more problematic. Let's further divide each of those steps into 2 pieces. So we're going to say that I'm going to take my data cache, here, and I'm going to divide it into 2 parts and have it take 2 cycles to do that. Same with my instruction cache, my register file read, and my math I'm going to do in 2 steps over 2 cycles, where the idea is, for each of these sort of divisions, I can say do the second half of the math for instruction A while doing the first half of the math for instruction B. So I'm assuming I can divide things up that way, and we'll talk about, it probably seems like, can we really divide up a math, an addition circuit that way, and a register file that way? That's a real good concern. We'll talk about that next, but let's assume we can do that. We can divide them up and kind of split them in half. And make it so we can do, the first half for one instruction while doing the second half for a different instruction. And so by doing this, I've doubled the number of Python stages to 10 and halved my cycle time. What's my new throughput? So, little time to look this up. Okay, so who thinks A? B, C, D, E. Okay, so we have consensus that by doing this, we've doubled our throughputs. We have one instruction every 250 gigaseconds instead of 500. So I just cut the circuit in half, add some registers where I cut it in half, and I just double my throughput, right? I just keep going. So I can divide it in half again. And again, I can just make my processor infinitely fast. And obviously, we can't make it infinitely fast. So the question is, what's the constraint, that keeps this from working in practice? And there's a bunch of things that are going to kind of limit how many pipeline stages, how far we divide our instruction execution into finer and finer steps. So the one issue is that the registers I've added, I've kind of acted as if they don't do anything. They don't take any time. They just store values and they're free. But they aren't free. They're physical hardware that is not instantaneous. So let's say, for example, the register takes 10 picoseconds to register, to store a value. It needs some time for the circuit to stabilize and to, read that value within the clock cycle. So this means that let's say I start with 100 picoseconds of logic and I somehow divide that logic exactly into 2 pieces that take 50 picoseconds. Well, to do pipelining, we need to put a register in between those 2 pieces so we can have the second half working on one instruction with one set of values, while the first half has a completely different set of values that are isolated. This register is going to add, some time that we need to account for when we set our cycle time. We can't set our cycle time to 50 picoseconds, even though that's how long the math part takes. We need to add the extra 10 picoseconds for the registers to store the values for the next step. And this overhead gets worse and worse as we kind of divide up our stages into smaller and smaller chunks. And at some point, it's just not going to be worth trying to make the stages shorter. Some questions? partners. Yeah.
So how does this work with context switches if we're like executing parts of instructions?
So question, how does this work with context switches if we're executing parts of instructions? So in our diagram here, when we do a context switch, what are we doing? We're going to be copying a bunch of values from memory to registers and from registers to memory. So we're just going to add a bunch of move instructions to this pipeline and execute them normally. The processor doesn't need to care. Does that answer your question? And yeah. There's going to be some bookkeeping about dependencies between instructions, but you know, as far as our processor is concerned, a context switch is just a funny way of reading and writing registers for the most part. Okay, so we have our diminishing returns here from why we can't just add infinite pipeline stages because of register delays. Another constraint is that we can't just divide a circuit up into evenly sized pieces. So like if I have an adder, I probably can't split the adder into two exactly the same size pieces. I can probably split it up I don't know how much we actually cover adders in CS01 these days, but yeah, we can do adders in steps, but they're not gonna be quite even steps. And when they're not quite even, you know, we get a lot less than the ideal return from pipelining. So here, I divided my 100 picoseconds into a 60 picosecond piece and a 45. You might say, why do these sum up to more than 100? Probably because it used to be that two of the operations overlapped by 5 picoseconds, and they can't anymore. And this seems pretty close to even, but, you know, my decrease now, my cycle time, went from 110 to 70, which is way far away from 110 to 55, which is kind of what I would naively expect. So we get a bunch less than the ideal return, you know, especially with this added that we can't actually split up the circuit into even pieces. And we have similar problems for like splitting up a data cache operation into multiple cycles. There's ways of doing it, because if you think of accessing a data cache, we like access the set and then we do something else. So there's a natural way of dividing that up into steps, but those steps probably aren't going to take the exact same amount of time. So we'll have some losses. And these losses are kind of the same thing we saw with my laundry example, where we had this wasted time because one step was slower than the others. And that's just going to inevitably happen with our pipelines because we can't really divide things up into a circuit where every step takes the same amount of time. So let's say I do this division and my new stages here take 240 picoseconds, except M1 takes 350 picoseconds. What's my new throughput? So revisiting our example where I split up every stage into two separate steps. What is my new maximum throughput? Question or answer? I'll do show of hands for answers. Okay. A question? Do we have a variable clock speed? So most processors do not support doing variable clock speed. There's been attempts to do this, but they have not seemed to have been something that's Actually, I should rephrase that. So there are a lot of processors with variable clock speeds. Variable clock speeds are not to solve this problem. Variable clock speeds are about, usually about managing heat. As far as, like, you know, we have some steps that are slower than others, that is generally not a problem we solve with variable clock speeds, because processors that have variable clock speeds, with a few kind of experimental exceptions, generally are not able to vary the clock speed like on an instruction-by-instruction basis. It's like on a second-by-second basis. And a second on a modern processor is like a billion instructions. So usually we in practice will not have variable clock speeds. It's just, you know, it's not impossible to do, but, you know, usually won't do that. So the show of hands. So who thinks our new maximum throughput is A, 1 over 240 picoseconds, B, 1 over 250, same as when we split it up normally, C, D, E, okay, so we have chances that it's C, and like with our laundry example, we're constrained by the slowest stage. And you might say, wait a moment, what if we're not running any instructions that use the memory stage? Like, by use, I mean, which do a data cache operation. Couldn't we make this faster? And that is not something we're going to be capable of doing in practice. So hypothetically, we could imagine a circuit that does that. The problem is that for that to be useful, we need to have a span of 10 instructions with no data cache access. Because if any instructions in the M1 stage doing useful work, we'd have to have the full cycle time. And that just makes it, you know, even if we could, you know, even if that circuit was kind of buildable, I think it makes it the trade-off not really worthwhile, right? Like, what programs are not going to access memory for 10 instructions a lot of the time? Not many useful programs. And in practice, like, it's apparent, it's, I think, a lot harder to have a variable clock speed based on what instructions are running, so we just don't do that. Okay, so one assumption I have written here, which has been pointed out is a problem here, is that I'm assuming no cache misses and that we can start a new instruction per cycle. And why that was a concern is that we have this issue with dependencies that I've kind of ignored. That conveniently here, this R10 is not the same as what the add writes to. The add writes to R9, and then we use R10. And it sure seems like it would be really problematic if we try to use that R9, because it's not actually computed. Like, we want to read it here, but it's not really computed until here, and it's not written to the register file until there. That seems like a problem, and it is. And we call this problem a data hazard. So here I have a timeline where time goes down of executing this set of instructions, and I'm showing at each stage what's stored in the registers between each set of stages, where I'll say the PC is a special case. And we're going to say that this instruction's at address 0, and this one's at address 2, and then this is 4 and 6. Just assume they're 2-byte instructions. So in this case, kind of my timeline is I load my add instruction by sending 0 in cycle 1 to the instruction cache, and then in the next cycle, I get 8 and 9 going into my register file to read. And at the same time, I'm loading the next add instruction, all perfectly normal, and so that's what's showing here. And then I'm going to be adding register 8 and 9's value while I'm reading register 9 and 8 for the second add instruction. And we have a problem here, which is that when we finish reading register 9 and 8 for the add instruction, well, I'm going to read register 9, which is going to be 900, because we haven't written the sum yet, which should be 1700. And this is because, you know, that value is not written until here. Or not here, sorry, till we get to cycle 4. And the problem that this creates is that here we have the wrong value sent to R8. That the result of the second add is incorrect. So this seems like a big problem that I made my processor a bunch faster and also made it give the wrong answer. And giving the wrong answer is not really acceptable. So obviously we're going to fix this somehow. And what's going on? We call this a data hazard. A hazard is a general term for any case where a pipeline doesn't do, you know, what the sort of base processor would do as far as what's computed and all that without changes. And kind of what's going on here is the problem is that in our pipeline implementation, we read the registers, then write them. That's the order we execute these two instructions. But the specification of how the instructions work says that we read a register, write the register, and then move on to read the registers for the next instruction. So by changing the order in which we run the parts of this instruction, we violated the specification, the manual we wrote for people writing assembly about how does add work. How does add work? You read two instructions, you read the registers, add them together, and store them. And the reason I'm bringing up that this sort of violates the specification of the instruction is that the simplest fix to this problem, as far as the hardware manufacturers are concerned, is that, well, the problem here is that stupidly we wrote a specification of an add instruction that told you the add instruction writes the values right away. That's really hard to implement, so we're going to just change that and might tell you that when you write an add instruction, you just need to keep in mind the way an add instruction works is that it writes the values 3 cycles later, and you just need to write your assembly with that in mind. And if you're a compiler, that means when you write an add instruction, you just need to add some knobs, you know, when you have this dependency. And this might sound like a crazy idea. We have an add instruction that doesn't work right away. This is a real thing that a small number of processors have done. Because as far as hardware complexity and performance, it's a very nice solution. The problem is that, well, it's definitely hard for humans to write assembly with these sorts of restrictions. And it turns out it's compilers, you know, they can deal with it, but they're not great at it. And probably the bigger issue is that this tells us we have to recompile every time we change the processor. So I talked about, oh, we could have more stages or less in our pipeline and get better performance. In this design, if I want to do that, I have to change, you know, for the new processor, I have to change how add instructions work and tell the compiler, now you need to write add instructions differently. You know, you have to know, keep in mind, it doesn't take connect 3, now it's 4. And we have to recompile our software. And as much as sort of architecture researchers in the 80s and 90s thought that this wouldn't be a problem, it turns out it is. That people really don't like recompiling your software all the time, so that's not really an acceptable solution. And one minor note about this is I'm assuming we can read a register value while it's being written back here. If you look carefully at this case here, we better not do that here, because if I'm, say, computing R8 and R9's value, and I'm writing R9, we don't want to read the value we're writing. That would be, you know, cause us to compute the wrong value. So to make that work, I'm assuming that, you know, we have that the register file has actually been modified to allow us to read a value while it's being written, which for a pipeline processor is generally something we'll do. But it's not actually the way the register file used to work. So if the register file worked the old way, we need actually three knocks. Okay. So this is kind of our simplest for the hardware solution, and definitely really complicated for everyone writing assembly and compilers. And as I alluded, this is kind of unacceptable for most people. So the simplest hardware solution that the software people find acceptable is something we'll call stalling. That rather than having the software writers insert the knocks, the hardware will do that. So to make this work, we're going to add some extra logic which detects, oh, this instruction is trying to use R9, which is currently being computed. I need to wait until R9 is done being computed before I let it proceed to this next step. So we'll add some extra logic that kind of keeps the register values from changing. In this case, where we detect that the register numbers match up and something is off. And this idea is called stalling. And this is kind of the simplest thing that, you know, we consider an actual solution that doesn't change our assembly language to this data hazard problem. And it's also conveniently a solution that's going to always work. We're going to talk about a more performant solution, but it's not always going to work. But this idea, we can always solve a hazard by just inserting knobs until things advance far enough in through the stages of the pipeline. So questions on stalling? Some people look. Nope. Okay. Thought I had some. Okay, so I talked about this hazard, this what I call the data hazard. You might say, well, if you said data hazard, is there some other types of hazards? Yes, and there's one that's particularly important, and that's control hazards. That if we think of sort of comparing and then doing a conditional jump, well, the result of the comparison isn't going to be available in time for us to know what to fetch after the jump, right? That in this design, in cycle 2, if I fetch the compare in cycle 0, I want to figure out what the result of the comparison is and fetch the instruction that's either the add or whatever is at address FFFFF. But if I try to do that, I've just read the values from the register file and I'm still computing the comparison when I need to actually start accessing that next instruction. So this is called a control hazard. Like the data hazard, it's a case where our pipeline, if we just set it up, doesn't do the right thing. And we're going to need to do some extra work to make this happen. And conveniently, our stalling solution also works in this case. So kind of the simplest way of solving this problem is saying, well, I don't know what the PC should be here. So what I'll do instead is I'll just insert some knobs while we're waiting to figure out what that has to be. And I have two under the assumptions that my compare sets the flags, the jump reads the flags and figures out what that means the next instruction to run is. And once that's computed, I can use that. So my timeline is I send the flags, I compute the flags and use them in cycle 2. I use the flags in cycle 3. I compute the address to go to in cycle 3 and use that in cycle 4. And that means I have to have wait for 2 cycles to actually, you know, you do the jump correctly. And so I insert 2 nops while I'm waiting to figure out what's the actual next instruction to run. Questions? This sort of stalling resolution to our control hazard. So there's a neat trick we can use to sometimes get rid of this stalling for these control hazards. And that trick is, well, there are just 2 possibilities for what should go here, right? It's either the XOR or whatever instructions at the label. So what we can do is we can make a guess. So for example, I could guess that if I have this, say, JNE here, that after the JNE, we should run the XOR. And if I make that guess, I can just start doing it. And the question is, what happens if my guess is wrong? And if my guess is wrong, all I need to do is undo the guess before it's too late. And that's, you know, simple to say, maybe not so simple to implement. But for a pipeline, it turns out it's not that hard to implement. So if I make this guess, this would be my execution. There's no stalling here, no waiting. I just start running the XOR. And when I'm right, my things are just as if it wasn't a jump. Now the problem is that the case when I'm wrong is going to be a bunch more complicated. So when I'm wrong, I need to figure that out. And in this example, I'm going to figure it out after we run the execute stage of the jump, after we use the flags to compute what's the actual address we want to jump to. And if I'm wrong, I'm going to replace the instructions values for the XOR with those for a nop. I'm just going to strip all those values that are currently being computed and replace them in my registers between stages with the ones for an op, and the same for this move that I shouldn't have run. These are our guesses that were wrong. So I'm just going to replace them with an op in the pipeline, meaning that rather than sending the XOR stuff to the math circuit, I'm going to send a NOP stuff to a math circuit. And rather than sending, you know, register 11 and 12 to fetch to the register file to read, I'm going to send no registers to read. And we call this idea squashing instructions. That's what we call undoing these instructions after you've started. And so this idea is called branch prediction. So we're predicting where the branch, the conditional jump, will go. When we're correct, we kind of speculate and get lucky, and we get some extra performance. And when we're wrong, well, we did some extra work to squash the instructions, but performance-wise, this is actually just as slow as stalling would have been. So this is going to give us a big performance benefit in that, you know, when we're right, we have better performance. When we're wrong, we're just as slow as we would have been anyways. So it only helps us. So that's kind of our undoing instructions. And, you know, in this case of our 5-stage pipeline, the undoing instructions is just kind of changing what's in those registers going between instructions. In more complicated pipelines, it can be a lot more work to undo these partially executed instructions. For example, notice that when I squashed these instructions, they hadn't actually written anything to memory or registers. If they had, this would make the squashing operation way more complicated. And there are processors that deal with squashing in those cases, but in this five-stage design, which is what the early pipeline processors were, that's not such an issue. So questions about this prediction idea? So this is, yeah. How do you choose which way you predict? This is something for which there are lots of design decisions with trade-offs. So if you're making a static prediction, generally the best heuristic is forward not taken, backward taken, meaning that if it goes to a higher address, you say it's not taken. If it goes to a lower address, you say it is taken. And the reason why that heuristic works well is because that's how loops work. Then if it goes backwards, it's probably continuing a loop. If it goes forwards, it's probably exiting a loop. So that's an example of kind of a simple, reasonable strategy for guessing. But modern processors have much, much, much more complicated ways of making guesses that can achieve surprisingly high accuracy, like 99.9% plus correction rates. And these are usually based on sort of recording what's happened in the past and using that to inform the prediction for the future. And why do modern processors like have these very accurate predictors? It's because they're using a design, which we'll talk about when we talk about out-of-order processors, where for them to get good performance depends even more on making these guesses correctly. They don't have a five-stage pipeline that runs one instruction per cycle like this. They have something where if they get the guess wrong, the penalty is much, much higher, something like 20, 30 instructions worth of time. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So I talked about a nice solution for our control hazards. Nice in that, like, it was better than stalling and better than telling the compiler that now the way jump instructions work is that you wait two cycles and then they jump. We're going to talk about next time about a more elegant solution to our data hazard problem, but I'll preview that to start out, and we'll talk about the details of how it works next time. And the key insight for this solution is that I was previously saying we had to stall for two cycles when we had a data hazard because I needed to wait for the value to be computed. But it actually was computed. The value is computed, but not written to a register yet. So the trick we can do is that we can say, well, if it's computed already, we just need to get it to where it's going to be used, replacing the bad value we got from the register. And if we do that, we don't need to stall. We don't need to wait for it to be written to the register. We can just take it now. And this idea is called forwarding. So basically what we'll do, so for this particular case, we'll just add a little wire to send the value back and control it with a mux. And we'll talk more about how this works next time. Obviously, this is not the only case we need to handle because it could be somewhere else the value is computed. And, you know, we need to think about how does this mux get set. We'll talk about that next time.